Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 211 of the Distraction Pieces podcast, and by God, have I got a good one for you this week. This week, I visited Headway, East London specifically, but Headway are an organisation that has places all around the country and a great online presence as well. But I'll rewind it, I guess. I got a message on social media from a lady called Natalie Clapshaw, who I speak to in just a moment. And she just kind of wanted to give me some information on what Headway do and invite me along to come and have a look around. And I went down there and had a look around, and it was amazing. I was taken around by two different people at the centre. And Headway, I should jump straight in with that. Headway is a charity or an organisation that works with people who have had brain injuries. So they've had an accident of some sort and they've had a brain injury, and then they're trying to recover from that and to live with the changes that a brain injury can cause, the changes that often aren't visible or aren't clear to anyone other than you, or can be clear to other people. You know, there's so many weird, unusual complications in there. So, yeah, it felt like an important one and a special one. And I went down and had a look around. I was blown away by everyone that worked there and by everyone who I met who was in there visiting and getting help or giving help. I mean, we go into all of that. So, I mean, it's quite a long chat, so I'll jump straight into that. But normally I would do a plug here for speechdevelopmentrecords.com. But this week I'm just going to send you in the direction of headway.org.uk. So it's headway.org.uk. And as we go into in the podcast, it's the website alone as a starting point, if nothing else, has got great sections there for people who've recently had a brain injury, or people who have been living with a brain injury for a while, or people who just know someone who's had a brain injury, friends or relatives or loved ones, partners, family members, anything. And it's really important for all of those things to be addressed and to be helped. It's such a complex a subject. We get into it in the podcast, and Natalie is far better at articulating and talking about it all than I am in this intro. So I'll jump straight into that. Thank you everyone for all the love for the last a few weeks episodes. Still a lot of love for the Martin Freeman episode. People are going crazy for that. The Wells Comedy Festival Live and the Ask Pip episodes. In fact, I'd mention, if you enjoy this, I've done a few kind of charity specials as such, or focusing on organisations. I'm going to list them off now. I've got all my Polaroids in front of me on my phone. So I did, on episode 13, I talked to fullfact.org, Will and Phoebe. And Full Fact are an organisation that fact checks stuff that politicians have said, that newspapers have said, that's social media sites have said. And they're not left wing or right wing. They're just, you know, they're just looking at facts. Obviously, a very popular one was episode 42, which was the Refugee Week special I did with the British Red Cross, talking to an amazing young lady who's a refugee called Ramel. That's fantastic. That was one of the most moving ones I'd done at that point. It stunned me. On episode 52, I did a Greenpeace special with two Bens and a Frank. And they're people who work for Greenpeace, and one of the guys there was one of the guys who was taken and put in a Russian prison for protesting a tanker. So yeah, that's amazing episodes. I'm making this a really long episode, aren't I? But it's worth, I mean, if you want to skip through my recommendations and get straight to the talk, you can. I did a cool one with a Green special, episode 72, with Dale Vince, who started a company called Ecotricity, which is all green electricity, which since then I've had all my electricity and gas from Dale Vince, and they're completely green and they're wonderful. Let me see other really good kind of organisation ones. I mean, episode 121 was with Dignity in Dying, and that was talking to Lloyd and Mick, one of whom works for Dignity in Dying, and one of whom, you know, has had to to go through these things of taking someone abroad to have them choose to end their life. It's a dark and heavy subject, but somewhere in there is the Safe Housing for Women special that was amazing. 135 was a two-part, it was a homelessness special with a charity called Mustard Tree and an organisation called Haircuts for the Homeless. They're both well worth a look. And that's probably it, right? That's all the charity type ones. Oh, I did the Ben and Jerry's one that a lot of people don't realise. 165 was actually a lot about charity and the work that they do. So yeah, there's some good ones to get your teeth into. I think that's all of the organisation-y ones. I really want to find the Safe Housing for Women episode number to give you that, because that was incredibly moving. I got to talk to an amazing a young lady called Mira, who was brought to this country as part of sex trafficking. And she chose to tell her story openly and honestly. And that episode actually ended up getting nominated for a humanitarian award that I had to go to, like, the Houses of Parliament for these awards. It didn't win, but that's fine. But, yeah, it's an amazing episode, and it was episode 86. So all of those have been mentioned there. Come back at the end if you fancy digging into any of them. But for now, enjoy this Headway special with Natalie Clapshaw. Right, I'm rolling. I'm joined today by Natalie Clapshaw, and we're at Headway. How are you today?
I'm all right. It has kind of been one of those days where it feels a bit chaotic and manic, but had a really good support group this morning.
Yeah.
Just kind of on the come down from that a little bit.
Yeah, completely. To be honest. I've just had a bit of a tour around, and there's a lot to talk about. But let's kind of start by explaining what Headway is and what you do here and who you help and how you help, essentially. Yeah. In the centre, there's more we want to talk about in Parliament and so on
yeah, after absolutely. That. But yeah. So Headway East London is a charity that's based, and we cover 13 boroughs of East London.
Yeah.
So we stretch quite far out. We're kind of Camden, Islington to Enfield, Westminster, Newham, Haringey. Yeah, so we cover quite a broad spectrum of London.
Yeah.
And we are affiliated to the national charity, which is Headway UK. But yeah, we have our own charity number, so we provide all the funds ourselves kind of do all the stuff that we do here. So we support anyone, any adults with acquired brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
So that can come from numerous circumstances.
Yeah.
So going from assault, gunshot wounds, sporting incidents, stroke, neurological conditions, kind of anything like that. Again, a huge spectrum there. And we hear such random incidents, and some of the things we hear were just, how are you so strong to have survived that? That's just mind-blowing.
I mean, that's one of the most amazing things with acquired head injuries is the first reaction is, exactly that. How have you survived this? How have you come out the other end? But then what often happens is the reaction after that is, good work, congratulations, and not, how's it affected you? How's it changed you? Because, as we'll discuss a lot, it is an invisible disability. There can be changes, not only invisible, are really hard to kind of describe and quantify from simply a simple thing as feeling like a different person. That sounds stupid. It sounds like you're saying, I've lost my confidence and like that, but it can be the opposite. It can be either way. It can be, but that's unimaginable to feel like you're not you anymore. And because it's acquired brain injury, it's stuff that you've lived a certain amount of your life one way and then there's a change. It's not simply you're born with something or this or that. It's that there's been a change for what you're receiving and perceiving and taking in.
Yeah, absolutely. And it affects such a, it doesn't affect just the person with the brain injury. Obviously, it has that kind of domino effect on families, carers, friends.
Yeah.
You know, we had a really interesting conversation in the support group this morning about friends.
Yeah.
And actually how friendship is so difficult to maintain, especially friendships that were developed pre-injury.
Yeah.
And then, like, you summed it up beautifully, is that it's an acquired disability.
Yeah. Yeah.
So before, people will perceive themselves as normal, and I use normal in however yeah. you personally perceive that to be.
Yeah.
And then to then change, and again, it's hidden. So you may look the same, you may sound the same, mm-hmm. but what's going on inside that's hidden so beautifully with our skulls, you know, yeah. It is a very different matter, and how people cope with that and adjust to that is a very complex journey, which is kind of what we do,
and on both sides of that, you can completely right, there is the side of friends or family or loved ones or whomever else who are now confronted again with potentially a different person,
yeah.
which is, that's hard to handle, but equally from the point of view of the person, there's often, from the experiences I've had, there's often a perception that they're aware of changes that no one else is aware of,
yeah.
and it's hard to put that into words or articulate, but it means that they feel distance from that person or a million different things. So even if the friends are trying to be as supportive and attentive as possible,
yeah.
there's certain things that if it's a change inside them that they can't, without help and assistance, articulate or even get their own head round.
Or may not have kind of, and organically may not have any insight into that they are different. You know, the brain is
100%, yeah.
is so complex and just, you know, I sound like a total nerd and I'm not medically trained, but the brain just fascinates me.
Absolutely.
And the way it copes with situations, you know, the brain will adapt and cope. And actually, if it feels that having insight into the injury and the changes that you've had since your injury, if that's going to affect you in such a poor way, in a negative way, the brain will just go into denial.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to just push. There's nothing wrong with me. I don't know what the problem is.
Completely.
Leave me alone. I'm fine.
And there's also often the assumption that going through something makes you an expert in it. And when I had just Tom on the podcast, who's got Tourette's, I spoke to her about Tourette's and she knows loads about it. And it made me realise how little I know about stutters. I've had a stutter since I was 4 or 5.
Yeah.
I don't understand it at all. She was telling me stuff about stutters that I didn't know. So it's similar there. And the issue as well, that one of the most prevalent and first things that often comes from traumatic brain injuries is affecting the memory.
Yeah.
And that can be a really tough thing when you're finding out what's happened to you and what your changes are, and then you might not remember that. So you might not be able to relay that to all your loved ones. You know, the hope would always be that there's someone there with you to listen as things are being explained by doctors or experts.
Yeah.
But that's not always the case. It's we do have a stretched NHS and collection of experts, so it's essential to have people who aren't experts but have experience or aren't trained in this to fill that gap and kind of try and go, look, this might be what's happening.
And yeah, and I think, you know, I've been in brain injury now for 12 years.
Yeah.
And I think through my experience of working with so many different people from different backgrounds and different family situations and how they're dealing with it and what resources they have to deal with it, is the one thing I can say to people is become your own expert of your own brain injury.
Yeah.
That, you know, kind of own it.
Yeah.
And that's a really difficult concept to put across to somebody, especially when it's quite a new diagnosis or a new kind of very newly acquired. Because it's like, I don't want to be this person. I want to go back to normal. I want to go and do all that. But actually, the more education you have around what's happened to you, then the adjustment kind of journey becomes a lot clearer. And
Absolutely. And hopefully your own comfort becomes a little clearer as well. Because I think another tough thing with any invisible disability is, particularly with brain stuff, it can manifest in ways that, through no fault of your own, to new people could come across as rude, or, you know, not turning up or cancelling things or not introducing yourself, or certain things that can just go.
Yeah.
And if the other person isn't aware, even a friend's as supportive as they can be, once people have got through a traumatic experience, it's easy for them to forget that this is a long-term thing, potentially a permanent thing.
Especially if you look well.
Yeah,
you know, especially if you're still...
You've done, again, you've got that real, as you said, the first
a reaction. And when I've experienced it, it's been like, oh my God, the fact that you've lived through this, you're literally a superhero.
Yeah.
You're literally the most impressive. This is the most, I've never seen anything like this. It's unimaginable. And that isn't fair because that's putting that on them. It feels supportive, but they're not a superhero. They're a human who's got through this as best they fucking can, but they're not a superhero. They're not invincible. They're not impenetrable.
They certainly don't feel it. And then, to have everyone surrounding you like, you're incredible. This way. And actually that person may be lying there just thinking, I'm not a fucking hero. I just want to get back to work. I want my legs to fucking work again, you know?
The most is to feel broken or to feel incomplete or to feel not the person you were.
Mm.
So no matter how much people say, wow, a look at you, you're laying it. Again, it can make it worse. The more people are, because they're then putting on an expectation of you to be even better than you previously were, because now you're a superhero as well. And if you're feeling not only not a superhero, but below what you were originally, that's incredibly restrictive and can make it hard to ask for help or to gain help or to share these things, because you kind of have that completely unwarranted shame, but completely understandable in the given situation.
And I think there are like especially two statements that we always say, and we've discussed this at length, and I discuss this a lot with people that I work with, and it's come out quite prevalent. Two statements that the worst thing to say to somebody with a brain injury is like, "Oh, but you look well." So that's number one. Never say that.
Yeah.
And the other thing is if people start to gain insight or start to share what they're going through, and they say, "Oh, you know, I'm forgetting everything. I'm losing my keys. Like, I walk into a room and I forget what I walked in there for." And so many people will be like, "Oh, well, I do that too. Like, don't worry about it. I'm always like that." And it's like, no, this is a different level. You have to explore that a bit more. And I think, you know, I work at the Royal London Hospital in Whitechapel for an early intervention project that we've started, which is great. It's been going on for 2 years now. But I feel so privileged because I get to be around these incredible people when they're just coming round, and so when they've just kind of come out of ICU, and I'm there at bedside with the family and the patient.
Yeah.
And it's a really great opportunity to be able to tell the friends and the family, okay, these are kind of pointers is not to do. Like, don't build this up as in, you know, this kind of superhero.
Because they're all well-intended as well. That's the thing on both sides of this. It's never tends to be anyone intentionally taking the wrong route or the wrong approach, but it's always a well-intended thing, but it can be
and also if it's such a trauma like that, you know, and any kind of trauma is never something that you expect to happen to you.
Yeah.
And that is to be said for a patient and their family. So they are coping in the only way that they know how with the resources that they have. And we don't come with a toolkit as to what's the best thing to say to somebody who's in a coma. What's the best thing to say to somebody who's just come out of a coma? We just, we're not ingrained in that, you know. And whenever trauma happens, I think we become quite primitive because we have to.
Yeah.
And especially with brain trauma, you know, if we think about kind of the structure of the brain and the frontal lobes, and it's all very, very complex executive functioning. But when there's been any trauma, I think we kind of resort back to our more primitive brain, which is very much like, I'm scared.
Yeah.
So I'm going to act kind of, I'm going to express fear. I'm going to express, anger and, you know, overt happiness. And
the lack of support given in those moments and those times or appropriate support, number one, is sad and inhuman. But number two, it can be dangerous because it can develop these things to be worse and worse and can cause dangerous behaviour or threatening behaviour to themselves or to others, you know, particularly to themselves, I think, is key. Because, again, if your only guidance and help through this is loved ones, people who knew you before, that can be a real struggle because there can be an urgency from friends and family to go, I'm here, I'm going to be strong, I'm going to support you, I'm going to get through this. Or from the individual to go, I'm going to pull myself together.
Mm.
Whereas coming places like this and being around other people who've been through it, or even just talking to strangers, not people who you will feel are comparing you to who you were before or anything like that, can be a massive thing, I think, because it can bring down some of them walls of defence or pretence of who you are or what you are, and just allow you to
Yeah.
To heal.
There are two ways of saying it. The day service is a safe environment for adults with acquired brain injuries to come and receive peer support and to explore and experiment with who they are now.
Yeah.
It's also just a place where you're not judged. And you just, you don't have to give a shit about what anyone thinks about you. Yeah. If you have epilepsy, you have a seizure here, everyone is just okay with that. Nice. Like, we'll just, we'll go through this, you know, we know what we're doing, nobody's gonna, you know, act inappropriately or call the ambulance straight away if it's something that we know about, you know, and it's
feel uncomfortable or put out or anything like that. I think the key is exactly that, the comfort that you were saying there, and not having to worry about what anyone else thinks. Because I think what I've seen from the walk around I've had is the huge variation in severity. There's some people who struggle to speak. There's some who, at first, I assumed worked here.
Yeah.
And then I realised, oh, no, you don't work here. You're here because you've had a traumatic brain injury. But, you know, it's all that. And I think it's tough on both ends of those spectrums, because if you feel, when you've been through something like that, it's quite acceptable to not want to feel disabled or broken or no, I'm all right, I've got through it, I'm all right. And you could at first think, I don't want to go to someone like this because there's people in wheelchairs, there's people who can't feed themselves and stuff like that. It's like, that's not me. But it's getting past that and going, no, you can come here and help, and that can help you, and you can come in. Everyone at different levels is all on a level as such.
Absolutely. And so many people, when they first come around to initially look, and so, you know, we give people a tour and kind of an induction day and see how they feel and if this is something that they want to be involved in, because it is all about choice, you know. A lot of the time there is a bit like, this is not me, like, I am so okay, I'm going to be back to work in like 2 weeks, I don't know what you guys are on about. And then, when we just kind of, obviously there's no pressure whatsoever, but we say, but, you know, maybe just experiment a little bit, just come for another day, maybe have lunch next time. And before you know it, they're in the art studio, they're creating these incredible pieces of work. They've never touched a paintbrush before. And then they class themselves as an artist. And it is giving people, you know, it's creating a new sense of self. And that's what we try to do here, you know, in the day service and the other services that we do provide out in the community.
And finding that variations of ways that you can engage here. As said, when I was being taken around, seeing the art studios and the music studios and all these different creative things, and the guy looking after the gardens out the back that look amazing. You can approach it either as, and again, this really is a variation of your comfort with where you are, with your own recovery, what you've been through. You can look at it either as, I can come here and this can help me, or you can look at it as, I can come here and I can help here, or I can come here and do stuff. But like the art studio, it's like, you could quite blankly say, I can come here and have free access to all this equipment and materials and all this amazing,
and support,
this amazing space and this amazing stuff. Yeah. It's like, that alone, and the music studio as well, amazing instruments and garage bands and beats being made and all that kind of thing. Go, well, you know, even if you do feel, no, I'm all right, I've got this under control, just come in and enjoy the facilities, you know.
Yeah, and I tell you what, the day service is kind of a really amazing insight tool. So to kind of approach insight and awareness for somebody with a brain injury is very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And it's, you have to be so sensitive about potentially opening that can of worms.
Yeah.
As you know, because we find that once people are, if they are in denial and that can of worms has opened, then naturally people kind of progress into depression. You know, for me, I have another, like, I will always promise to be honest with people, whether, you know, from a brain injury, or my friends, or, you know, I really try to be as honest as possible. And when people turn to me and they say, this is shit, and I just feel really low, and I just don't know what to do myself, I kind of say, good, I'm pleased, because that kind of means that we're out of that denial phase where you're not really going to progress and you're not going to start experimenting. The fact that you are feeling low, this shows me that we're kind of on the right track.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. And it's a really hard thing to do with people you care about.
Yeah.
But when someone is saying, look, I feel like, I feel that low, when you can kind of go, you should.
Yeah.
it's completely understandable and natural to feel that low. You've been through absolute hell.
Yeah.
You know, it's understandable feelings. And that's where someone slightly aside from the situation might have more comfort or be able to do that a little easier than a loved one who wants to be saying, no, it's all right. There's so much going. Even, again, it sounds so harsh. I've spoken a lot about depression and suicide and stuff like that, but at times telling someone there's so much to live for isn't going to get through when you're not inside that head. Because when they've legitimately got valid reasons to be thinking, I've got nothing to live for. And again, hopefully incorrectly, and that can change. But in that moment, I've struggled with that in the past because I'm similar. I'm a very honest and straightforward person. And when I've had people kind of say that and I'm sitting there thinking, I get it.
Yeah.
I get it, but it's really hard to know what to say or how to say, because you can't say, yeah, no, you're right, you haven't got enough. You know, that's horrendous.
Do that, mate. Yeah.
But it can be as damaging and as pointless to sugarcoat or to try and paint around it, because, again, all that will do is make them feel more distanced from you.
Yeah.
Because they can see that there's valid reason to see there's nothing ahead. So if you can't see that, then you're so far from the realities, it's a hard one to bring
it really
back
is
in.
And I think, you know, it's about embracing and being honest and saying, yeah, this is shit and I'm glad that you're feeling depressed. Now let's work together. Let's do something. Let's explore. Let's kind of look at your previous routine, which you're so desperate to get back to.
Yeah.
I don't, and I will say this to some people, I will say, I don't believe that you will be that person again.
Yeah.
I don't believe that. I don't think that is possible because of X, Y, and Z. And that comes, I've been called a bitch. I've been people have stormed out, and that's fine. I'm totally okay with that. But let's work together. And if you want to get back to that, then give me a chance.
Yeah.
And let's, kind of explore and experiment, because we're not just going to go straight back to being an investment banker in the city, working 70 hours a week. So let's look at if there's any kind of voluntary work you want to do, or let's look at your CV, or what works for you. You know, would you kind of be interested in some kind of therapy? So it's just breaking down those stages to potentially get to a point where, insight increases, mood generally increases once they kind of
and again,
start that process.
When you have anything taken away involuntarily, it is a natural instinct to romanticise it. Yeah. So again, to be able to say you might not get back to that is valid and true and helpful, because again, stuff has changed that might not be repairable. But you can also kind of look and go, remember when you hated that job? Or remember what you didn't, what is it you like about that? And we can look at how we can achieve that in other areas, if that isn't an option. It's easy to go, I want to be back to that person, and forget that the day before you had this accident or this incident, you were wanting to quit and you were miserable. But because the choice has been taken away, and that's the thing that's so hard to deal with as humans, I guess.
And I think, you know, the other guilty party of that, our family, you know, they romanticised this person who was an amazing husband. He was always, you know, we went out on day trips. He loved me. He was a great father. He was this, that, and the other. And actually, if you talk to their friends, like, he was a bit of a chit. Yeah, like, he was always at the pub. He was, you know, he always used to get home drunk and shout with the kids. He was never there for the bedtime story. Yeah. And that's another thing that makes it quite a complex thing working with these amazing people, is that you never get a true reflection of how that person was before.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, actually, for Bob to lose his temper like this, is that an effect of the brain injury,
or
was he always like this? And kind of, I don't think really no amount of kind of assessments or anything like that will ever give you that true reflection.
Completely. And it's not an easy thing to try and tempt someone into a potential, look, here's another path that we can go. We might not go back to where you were, but we can go somewhere else. Great. And a great, again, from the good and the bad, a great example of that is the comedian Sam Kinison, who was a lot bigger in America than he was over here. But his brother wrote a biography about him, and when he was a kid, he was a very quiet and shy kid, and then he was in a car accident and he had a traumatic head injury.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't have had his comedy career without that, because it was after that that he became loud and outgoing. And he's a very, he was very much kind of, you know, the bits where Bill Hicks gets to his peak. That's kind of where Sam Kinison lived, pretty much always at that kind of intensity. But it was genius that was opened by this injury or the removal of certain restrictions. So, again, it's not something that's easy to hear at the time, but there's a good chance that you might not be able to get back to who you were. But as you said, who you were might not have been the highest potential of what you can be or who you can be.
And you could maybe thrive in a totally different, you know, avenue. And I think what's wonderful about here as well is that if you talk to people that are part of our, like, cooking team, so every day here at Headway in the day service, we have a meal that is prepared and planned and prepared and cooked with assistance by our members.
Yeah.
And they class themselves as chefs. And quite rightly, like, that's now their kind of occupation, that's their profession. They are chefs. The people that are in the art studio, you know, we've had exhibitions at the South Bank.
And, well, the art studio was amazing.
They are artists, you know.
And some of the sculpture going on in there and some of the painting. And again, it was beautiful to see the complete range and variation. I could see one unfinished drawing that was just pencils, and it felt very childlike, still above anything I could achieve at this moment.
Me too. But
still, that kind of thing. And then you saw stuff that was just amazing, oil based, and then these creations that are all mosaiced up and made into these amazing animals and heads, and a lot of, again, how therapeutic, I guess, is all of that, because art, cookery, I guess, and music are things that get marginalised a bit in schools because they're not a here's the right and here's the wrong answer. But that's exactly the kind of thing you want somewhere like this, right, where there is no right or wrong answer. There is purely the expression. And you can be happy with it or not happy with it. That's completely fine.
Oh, my goodness. Like, some of the paintings take our artists here people will go back to it. I remember, so I worked at Headway Devon before coming here, kind of Devonshire bird, and we had a client there, and he took about 10 years to complete this one painting.
Wow.
And he's never happy with it, and but that was his therapy. He kind of just, he would sit back and he'd look at it and kind of really contemplative and think, what am I trying to put across with this painting? What do I want this to be? What do I not want it to be? And he would just pick it up maybe twice a year and kind of change it and adapt it. And it would really kind of reflect his mood as well. And I think that's another expression, is that the artist, they may not feel open to speak about how they're feeling.
Yeah.
They may feel that, you know, a lot of the staff here are quite young. And, you know, and female, like in the care industry, unfortunately, it is majority female. And a lot of the people we work with are young males who kind of maybe pre-injury have, you know, had to support and really look after people, and they don't want to express themselves. And, you know, I don't want to sit and do a bloody painting. Like, who do you think I am? Like, but you just give them time, and it is a real way, and you can see. You know, if the painting is looking quite, you know, dark colours or pretty, just quite a depressing piece, it can still be beautiful, but still quite kind of depressing. And you can think, right, there's something up. This is a real starting point of where we can explore that. But I mean, I'm not an artist myself.
Yeah.
We're so lucky. The person who runs the three girls that do it are incredible, and they know what they're doing.
I'm worried that literally every bit of music I've ever created would have you going, there's something wrong here. There's something not quite right. This is all quite dark.
Hang on, mate. You might want
to
read.
We need to have a chat. Do you find that the art classes and that are a good way of helping people relax and open up a little bit as well? Because I think often if you're coming somewhere thinking the sole purpose is I've got to mix and interact and deal with my problems, that's intimidating. Yeah. Whereas if the sole purpose is, look, I've got, my focus is I'm doing this, and then conversations can just start to happen and you can start to become more comfortable.
Definitely. I think the art studio is a real place for that. And also, you know, a lot of us aren't therapists. A lot of us aren't medically trained. You know, we're here because we give a shit and we find brain injury fascinating and, you know, we love what we do. So, yeah, we don't want to come across as like we're psychoanalyzing everything that people do, because that's exhausting for them. And my goodness, like these, the wonderful people here have enough appointments with different therapists who they may only meet like once in, you know, they'll meet all these neurospecialists who are great, but, you know, they may see six different ones in 2 years. They don't really get the time of day. They have to retell their story over and over and over new professionals. And that's something we want to step away from.
That's a huge...
Be yourself.
That's a huge issue and a huge problem with this as well, is there's, I guess, a limited amount of experts, but, yeah, the kind of horrific nature of having to relive it potentially every time you've got a different appointment with a different person and go, here's where I am.
Yeah.
That shouldn't be on the individual, right?
No.
That should be elsewhere, but it so often is that you're moved. But again, because the brain is such a misunderstood, or not misunderstood, we don't understand it. It's just like misunderstood implies that someone knows and the rest are getting it wrong. No one knows, really. Yeah. It's such an ununderstood area that you will, sadly, and with all mental health things as well, you will often have to go try a few different things because there's no, here's the solution. There's, well, let's try this. And that can be 6 months. That can be a year. That can be however long of trying to do this and then going, that didn't work. We're starting again. And that's...
And actually something that we have tried, A, it didn't work, and B, it's kind of put you back five steps. So, you know, we're having to start again from maybe a different position.
And now you have to be motivated to try a new thing when the last thing hasn't done any...
I know, so many people it's just like, you know, I really have not got the motivation to go to this other appointment. I've been going to these appointments for months, years, and I've just had enough. And, you know, I'm always trying to be like, but, you know, it's really, we have to think about the health benefits and what if this, and has your situation changed, and all of this rubbish. And actually, sometimes I just want to say, do you know what? I get it.
You're right.
I get it. Like,
stay here and do a premium.
Yeah, exactly. Let's go out in the garden. And
what is the relationship here with the hospitals and the GPs and that kind of thing? Because I guess there has to be some kind of interaction or trust or allegiance, I guess, in that, so that you're helping or everyone's pulling in the same direction, I guess.
You would, in a perfect world,
that would
happen, and it would happen beautifully.
Of course,
However, you know, we're really lucky. Like I said, we've got this early intervention project that's funded by the Big Lottery Fund.
Yeah.
So we've got only one more year of it. So I'm a bit like, oh, it's my job. So I go into the Royal London once a week, but we're looking to increase that, actually.
Yeah.
We're kind of thinking they have a head injury outpatients clinic,
which
I think captures people really at the moment, just maybe pre-crisis, where they've been discharged, they've had some community care, which is great, but that lasts for kind of 6 weeks.
And then you've
gone from an intensive environment like the hospital, where you've got kind of nurses buzzing around you, having assessments and all of this. You go home, which is can be quite a graded, like, gradual process. You're home, you're where you feel supposedly safe. You get some community care for 6 weeks, and then it's gone.
Yeah.
And that's when things really start to manifest. And that's when people really discover, like, actually, I am struggling making a cup of tea. Like, why is this? Am I going mad? Am I going crazy?
The horrific journey there of anyone, when you're in a hospital for an extended stay, you don't want to be there.
No.
You want to get home. So the crushing feeling of going home and it not being all okay, either something happening and having to go back or anything like that, or, as you said, just being, I'm not really sure how to do this at the moment, that's crushing, because that was the light at the end of your tunnel. And then you get there and it's not entrance sign to another tunnel. And you're like, oh,
I really thought this was going to be it, you know. And I'd rest in my own bed and I'd be back at work. So, yeah, that's a really emotional journey as well, isn't it? As well as a physical one. You know, we're thinking some people are discharged from hospital. When they went there, the day before, they could walk.
Yeah.
And now they're going home and they're in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
I mean, that, I can't comprehend how difficult that, and just...
Yep. And houses with stairs and steps.
Some
and
places have to have their doors widened
to
do that. Yeah, all the adjustments, a wet room, things like that to accommodate their disability. So they're home and, so these kind of start to manifest, like physical difficulties, cognitive, emotional, behavioural. And it takes that time for it to come apparent. And that's when, so generally after kind of 4 months, they'll go to the outpatient clinic.
Yeah.
And that's when, you know, that's when I really feel our presence would be good, because we can just capture it there.
Yeah.
And instead of saying, you know, when they say, oh, I'm going crazy, you know, we're like, there is a cause that is not your fault.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
if you had a broken leg,
yeah,
and I asked you 2 weeks down the line or a day after to go run a marathon, you'd tell me where to go.
Yeah.
You'd say that you're being unreasonable and you're an idiot.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of the same after a brain injury. You should not be expected to everything to just go back to normal.
Yeah.
So we're looking at developing that and hopefully that's having great. A presence there. But also, I mean, the emotional side of being in the hospital at bedside, you know, after where people are waiting kind of craniotomy, so they've got half of, like, part of their skulls missing. You know, for the family and kind
it's
of
terrifying for everyone, for the family to see, again, to see someone that doesn't look like the person they knew because half of their skull is missing, for the individual to have gone through something horrific and terrifying, survive, and then, God forbid, get to look in the mirror and go, where's the rest of me? What is this? What's
terrifying, gonna happen?
Right?
Like, yeah. And what you know, and sometimes a lot of people are like, "Why have you shaved half my hair off? How dare you? I didn't give consent for that."
Yeah.
Saying it saved your life, like we had to do that. Yeah, yeah. But at that moment in time, it's like, no, I need that back. I need my identity, and it is quite harrowing, like the emotions. And I have so much admiration to doctors, to nurses, to surgeons that are there all the time.
Yeah.
I just, how they don't become totally desensitized and unempathetic, I do not know. They are heroes. And also, like, at that point, then a lot of the time things come out in the woodwork when somebody has had a trauma.
Yeah.
You know, we've experienced people that have found out their husbands are having numerous affairs, so not only are they like, oh my god, you know, initially my husband, he's dying, oh, I need to be there for him, and then like an hour down the line they're on their phone and they see all this, and then, you know, I'm dealt with kind of these really complex emotions coming from these people of I hate him, but I love him, and I'm worried about him, and he might die. But
and again, that can be on either side of a traumatic injury. You could be in a situation where the day before you were thinking of leaving your husband.
Yes.
Now you've had this injury, and you're suddenly thrust into complete dependency and closer than ever.
Yeah.
When a day ago you were like, I'm done with this.
Yeah.
You know, it's so complex, I think,
you know, I know that sounds like quite an extreme example, but it happens so much.
I'm going to say it's going to be,
you know, and there are people that
or variations of that. I mean, that's a very specific, but everyone, if you think anyone listening right now, if you think of something in your life that's not perfect or that you want to change or your aim is to change, if suddenly the rug was pulled out from under you, how would that, you know, how would that be? How would that come about? And
so we're really, and I think so. It's great to have us there for those kind of moments,
because
the doctors and nurses obviously don't really have the time to do that. They're stretched as it is. So, and we can provide education there and then, and say this. We had one incredible lady who is now very much a part of our community here, and is fantastic. And she was about to be discharged, and my boss, who was doing it at the time, caught her and said, "Just to let you know, you know, I'm here, you know, we know that you suffered from an acquired brain injury. Yeah. Here's some information. I know you're being discharged today. If there's anything that you need, practical advice, here." This woman turned around and said, have I had a brain injury? Nobody's told me that that's what's happened. Nobody's given it that term, that it's an acquired brain injury.
Yeah.
We were like, wow, okay. This is why we're here.
Here's what's happened.
Because so many people are discharged saying, oh, I just had a smack on the head. Like, I'll be fine. I've had a knock to the head.
And there's again, the nature of our criminally understaffed NHS is that so much is put in notes and files, and so much is assumed that it's communicated to the patient when often it isn't. Or again, it's communicated to the patient when they're in no situation to take in that information. I've known of people in hospital who the nurse or whoever has turned up and said, are you meant to have one of these tonight or tomorrow? And they're like,
it's just,
I beg your pardon,
it's scary,
it's just like, or have you already had this, or have you already had that, and things like that. And it's like, that's terrifying. So to have someone there who isn't an emotional family member, who might be looking at you differently because they're emotional too, they're dealing with it as well, to have someone from the outside who's a stranger to go, this is nuts, isn't it? This is really mad. Here's what's going on. Here's what you've been through. And even to chase up these bits of information, that it's not as easy to chase up as a patient, because in those situations, there will often be a period where what the patient is saying isn't making any sense, isn't coherent, and that can cause, again, an understaffed hospital system to ignore some of the questions. Do you know what I mean? Ignore some of the stuff, because previously they've been going on about something that's completely alien. So, you know, it sounds really important to have as much of that kind of ability to be bedside for those kind of things.
And just have a level of normality there. Yeah. You know, like I keep saying, I'm not medically trained. Yeah. I am invested in brain injury.
Yeah.
And, yeah, like, let's just sit and have a chat. Let's go and have a cup of coffee. Like, this is shit for you. Let's go.
Do you have to make a point of regularly making it clear that they don't know you? Because, again, I can imagine that's confusing. It's like... Yeah. I don't recognise this person. Yeah. Who's this friend of mine? It's like, oh no, we're not. You've not forgotten me. We've never met.
This is cool. Like, I'm new. I'm new into your life. It's okay.
You don't have to know who I am. That's absolutely fine.
So yeah, I guess you know, we're really lucky where I am. We've got some amazing nurses that I have a really strong relationship with that are totally behind the project. So in that sense, yeah, the NHS they're incredible. But we're also there as a link between health and social care.
Yeah.
So obviously there are probably people have heard that there are cuts going left, right and centre within the local authorities and all across the country. And so we're just, and I think for me in the media, a lot of it is covered by, you know, elderly people, you know, maybe kind of learning disability, mental health. And I'm thinking, where's brain injury? Yeah. Like over 450,000 people were admitted last year. Right. Like, and there's one. This is where my facts come in.
Go.
One in 90 seconds. So there's always one admission in 90 seconds of a head injury.
Wow.
And these aren't. It's a lot higher, because if you look at like epidemiology, like, well, you could think of somebody that has, I don't know, half a tree stuck in their abdomen.
Yeah.
They're going to get admitted to hospital. Their primary diagnosis is going to be the fact they've got a tree in their tummy.
Get that tree out of their
stomach. Yeah, exactly. Whereas their secondary injury may be that when the tree hit them, they fell and they banged their head.
Yeah.
So it's actually the statistics are a lot higher. And I'm kind of thinking, wow, where is this promoted on the media? Like, why don't people know about this? Like, brain injury, head injury, traumatic brain injury. It's just, it's happening. Yeah,
and I think the media is a key part to bring up here, because I think in the 90s and 2000s there was a big fetishization of the evils of benefits scammers, and that became this huge thing that's like, oh, these people, they're not, he's exposed, he's not really got a broken leg and things like that.
They're getting playing golf with his wife and his six kids and all that.
And it caused a tightening up of these things, and it caused It removed a level of empathy that I think we really need to bring back, because there's a lot of people who aren't trying to scam anything, but again, have got issues that are hard to articulate, hard to complete forms, hard to even uncomfortable to. People who've got head injuries and want to feel normal maybe don't want to go, can I have some help? But
please, can I have 50 quid a week?
Yeah, exactly. And it's a weird one, because I also think that anyone, like, how can I word this? I don't know anyone who's got their shit together that's trying to do a benefit scam.
Yeah.
So if someone is doing a benefit scam, it's probably because of desperation anyway.
Yeah.
So I would rather a few desperate people scam some benefits and thousands of people who need help get help easier than we stop those few desperate people, fuck them, let them go hungry, and people who really need it struggle and get left off the system and overlooked and uncared and unsupported, right? That should be the focus. It shouldn't be on the few people doing scams. You go, cool, let them do their little scam. You know what I mean?
Honestly,
I'm not saying it's acceptable,
let them have it,
but still,
you know?
I have much more concern for those who are being overlooked than the small amount that are slipping through or sneaking through.
And I think for me, you know, I could bang on about the benefit system for a long time, because it's been a part of my job now for the last 2 years that I didn't necessarily sign up for. I didn't realise that this was going to be such an incriminating like epidemic. And it's now, it is taking up about 70-80% of my time, where, you know, I could be looking and working with people getting rehoused and, yeah. and kind of getting the correct therapy that they need and orchestrating that. But no, it's a lot to do with benefits. And Ken Loach, the wonderful, glorious Ken Loach, he was on Question Time a while back, and he said, actually, the majority of members of society and people that are reading and soaking in all this media think that it's about a third of all benefit claims are a scam.
Yeah.
A third of it. Ken Loach, obviously, he did a lot of research for his film I, Daniel Blake.
Yeah, which amazing film.
And it really did sum up a lot of the stuff that we go through. And it's actually, the figure is 0.07% that they've found that the claims are that are scams. And like you said, let those 0.07%, just let them have it. They've obviously got some fucked up stuff going on anyway. Like, if they need to do
that,
this.
It's because of the media perception of it that's given that warped view over the years. I had a relative at Christmas was saying, these food banks and that, does anyone actually really need them? You know, is this all a bit... And I can say, it's beautiful that you're in a situation to think that, but I've known a single parent who's a teacher who I've known to go hungry because they were too ashamed to go to a food bank because it was seen as a taboo or anything like that, or a shameful thing. People need help, and we should be far more willing to do that in society.
I don't understand. Like, for me, I mean, I'm probably quite naive. Like, I've been brought up around disability and people that need support, and I feel really privileged to have had that background.
Yeah.
I would never even think of it coming into my world to label these people as scum or... in my 28 years of being
a burden on society. And
I would never think I'd be like, fuck me, these people need help. What am I not doing? Like, can I help?
It's really interesting as well, because when I had Rutger Bregman on, who's got an amazing book called Utopia for Realists, he spoke about how the more... his book speaks of so many times in history that the more we help people directly with money, the less it costs in the long run because of the damages on or the burden on the health system, on policing, on all these different things that if you're at the real bottom of the run, you're going to be costing a lot of money there, whereas that assistance and help can change that hugely.
And I mean, we see it so like rawly, and it makes me really upset to think that. So when people apply for the general benefits that people apply for that we work with is ESA, so Employment and Support Allowance, which was incapacity benefit.
Yep.
So that now changed to ESA, and then PIP, Personal Independence Payment, that was Disability Living Allowance.
It's a good name.
Yeah, I know, do you know what? Whenever I got good an email branding from you, I thought, oh God, what does the DWP want now? And I was like, oh no, it's fine. so those are the two major benefits. And, you know, it's a really complex system just to apply for it. And that's why you kind of think, are they doing this on purpose? But I won't get into those theories.
But again, there will be parts of that because there was a point that the belief was you make it a little bit harder and it weans out the chances.
Yeah.
And it's like, it weans out the people that it's hard for. It weans out the people that have had injuries or something that are going to make this a taxing and challenging thing and be intimidated as soon as they try and can't get their head around it. That's another thing to make them feel broken or stupid or inable.
And I think, like, you know, coming from, so the initial thing is you have to make a phone call, right? You have to phone up. Only recently has it become a free phone number.
Yeah.
Shit, you not. Like, honestly, insane. Only recently is it now an 0800 number. It was a 0345.
Again, I mean, even the simplicity of that.
Yeah.
I've got a stutter. I'm really uncomfortable making phone calls. I will, and I do, but I'll do everything I can to avoid it. It's why, I mean, it's become a joke on the podcast, and I don't really discuss why, but it's why I've got the Domino's app, the Pizza Hut app, the Just Eat app, the Deliveroo app, because I'd really rather not ring someone if I can avoid it.
Yeah.
And that's just a mild stutter. That's not some huge thing. That's just, I'm not comfortable on phones. You know, I can use them if I need to, but that could be enough to put me off.
Yeah.
And that's like, me as a feeling quite able. That's me as someone, I've had that my whole life. That's not a sudden change I've had because of an injury or incident. That can be even more if you suddenly feel, I'm scared to do that.
And also trying to fight, or that if they need support, and a lot of the time people with brain injuries don't have that support network around them, and So, yeah, initially, phone call could be a, no, I'm all right, actually.
Yeah.
If they do go along to do the phone call, and if they, at the time, you know, when it wasn't a free phone number, if they had enough credit on their phone, and then it's like a 40-odd minute phone call that they ask for, you know, name, national insurance number, all of that, a bit about their injury or their disability. And then you get sent a form, which is about 40 pages, which in itself, look, people look at it and just think, just put it straight in the bin. You know,
yeah.
And then I think, you know, you were picking up on the points of, you know, the questions that are asked are, you know, they go into quite in-depth things about their care needs, their own kind of, you know, washing and dressing and all of that, and how they interact with people face to face. I mean, A, not only do you want to sit there and just sit and write a document about how shit you are, like, who wants to do that? I'll write a story about how great I am, thank you very much. So there's that. And also, again, it's kind of promoting.
Slay a few of them questions in. Slay a few of them in. Like,
I know.
What are you really good at?
Yeah. What's your favourite food?
Damn right.
And then not only that, and then this really just kind of promotes the fact of how complex brain injury is. If you've got somebody who has got no real insight into their difficulties, they're not going to tick anything. They're going to be like, I'm fine.
Yeah.
And so they're not going to be entitled to that benefit whatsoever. And actually, those are the people who probably need it the most, that are probably the most vulnerable of society, are those that don't think that there's anything wrong, and that they're fine and they're walking through life.
Or again, the kind of the way a lot of people are brought up is the fear of asking for help anyway.
Yeah.
So if you're giving them multiple ways to just walk away and try and deal with it in a hellish hole on their own, then a lot of people will take that, and that's the opposite of what you need.
And
again,
I think
in reality, the more boundaries you put up, the people that will be most motivated are the tiny amount who are trying to scam something.
Yes,
because it's worth it for them, because they're going, I need to get this. Whereas if you're really struggling, they're the people that will be tripped up by these different...
And that's where we feel that maybe the system is just not equipped or adapted to deal with vulnerable people. And obviously, from our perspective, brain injury.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the people... You know, I support people as much as I can to make these claims, but I end up going a bit stir-crazy doing it, you know? And, like, anyone that has ever phoned the DWP will know exactly what I mean when I say I go into like a Vivaldi psychosis. The holding tune is the Vivaldi thing.
Yeah, right, okay.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
You know, I was on the phone earlier on hold for about an hour and a half, just listening to the same tune over and over. And it does send you a bit kind of, you know, psychotic.
Yeah.
But then and I'm sure that people who are aware of this whole system know about the assessment process. So having to go along, so you know, you send your form and then you're then asked to come along to an assessment. And we've had very
to go through any of that face to face is horrific. Again, we live in a time where we've got a lot of technology. There should be ways of entering as much of this information once.
Mm.
And then it being shared and dealt with, and not having to, because again, these injuries, more often than not, the experience themselves would be damaging.
Yes.
Without the head trauma, the experience itself would be mentally damaging and potentially permanently changing in your life. So to have to relive that repeatedly and probably quite matter-of-factly and casually, So then what happens? Do you know what I mean? It's like,
exactly.
That's probably really hard to deal with without a traumatic head injury as well.
Yeah.
Add that in and, it's ridiculous, right?
And also, like, the build-up.
Again, the thing that just keeps getting hit is the fact that the technology is we live in we've progressed with technology. We shouldn't have to be on hold for 90 minutes.
Yep.
Because then when you're actually having the conversation, you're already stressed and broken. You're already at the end of you already just want it to end.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know,
Has been broken by Vivaldi at that point. And
oh, my goodness, yes, it has. Yeah. And I think as well, like, if we counter in fatigue, you know, if we think about tiredness after brain injury, fatigue is a huge thing. And we a lot of the people that we work with here describe it as, it's not tiredness. This is a physical shutdown. I'm like a computer that has just had to, you know, be turned off. Yeah. You will not get anything from me.
Yeah.
But people kind of just react to social cues and just say on the phone, and it's like they'll just say yes, no. They may not be knowing what they're signing up to or yeah. what they're saying yes or no yeah. to, and that in itself is exceptionally scary.
And that happens in non-stressful or traumatic situations. Yeah. I've had it recently with a bank where I was on hold for so long that when I got through, I was just angry and ratty.
Yeah.
And I'm someone who genuinely, I really enjoy learning if I'm wrong on something.
Yes.
And this was the thing, I waited for ages. It'd been weeks and weeks. I finally got through. We got about halfway through and they explained why I'd just made a mistake. And I would not accept that. And I love accepting that. I was like, well, it's not acceptable. And they're like, no, you've done the wrong one there. I was like, that's not yeah. the point. The point is, and it was, and again, I felt like an idiot afterwards because I was like, no, that wasn't me. I tweeted about it. I tweeted angrily at Barclays and everyone was like, yeah, they're rubbish. And then I'm like, oh, fuck, man, that was just me. But it was because of that was, and again, that's yeah. not a traumatic or stressful thing that I was trying to solve. That was yeah. a mild annoyance.
Yeah.
That wasn't a life-changing and life-affecting thing. That was a mild annoyance and it pushed me there. So and having gone through all of that and then having, you're fighting for your... It sounds dramatic, but you're fighting for your survival there.
You're
fighting to have money on the table to live or support even. Mm-hmm. Often some of the different injuries will mean physical or technical changes in cars, in living rooms, in yeah. beds, safety if you're someone who has epileptic fits and yeah. things like that. A lot of practical changes
yeah.
that cost money
yes,
and you need support for.
And I think, you know, there have been some statistics that have come out that... have said, you know, people died when the changeover from incapacity yeah. benefit to ESA, and that's the reality, people are dying. Mm-hmm. You know, I know people that have committed suicide that because of their benefits, that they yeah. that it wasn't a more simpler process. People are going hungry, people are obviously accessing food banks.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, obviously I'm going to always bring it back to brain injury because yeah. that's kind of what I know. But, you know, you're asking somebody to go through what I feel at times isn't quite an incriminating process. And a lot of the people we work with, if you think about it logically, you know, will have frontal lobe damage. So, you know, from any assaults or kind of, road traffic accidents, our frontal lobe is 33% of our brain. So it's a huge chunk of it. Mm. And it kind of captures and it holds who we are, our personality, our braking system. So yeah. I know if I see somebody, if I saw somebody that I really don't like,
yeah.
I wouldn't just call them a big fat C word.
Yeah,
you know, I
yeah.
know that I'm like, no, okay, I dislike them. I may have a few words with them later, yeah. but I'm not going to cause a scene.
You think privately, maybe do a subtle Facebook update or tweet yeah. that's not direct.
Exactly. And I'm very good at being passive aggressive. It's one of my talents. But after a brain injury, that braking system isn't there.
Yeah.
It's like the frontal lobes are just always on green, whereas we have amber and red, and we kind of can think about it and be quite reflective.
Completely.
But and it's so true. And if you look at the statistics again, they're saying after some new research that was done by this guy Hugh Williams, that's based down in Devon, who works a lot in the justice system and brain injury, 80 to 90% of all of the people in prison have some form of acquired brain injury.
Crazy,
which is just an insane yeah. figure.
Yeah.
And like homelessness as well, we've just started, yeah. you know, there's a lot of homelessness projects in London at the moment about identifying people with acquired brain injury. And again, yeah. such a high figure of those people are, you know, have an acquired brain injury.
Who could have been helped before
exactly.
it got to that point.
Yeah.
You know, and again, that it not to keep going on about this Rutger Bregman guy, but he blew me away, but part of his thing of universal basic income was if everyone gets, say, $1,000 a month, mm. just regardless of who you are, what you are, the money saved on homelessness and all these other, on so many services
yes.
that have to yeah. be manned and looked after is huge. You save money there. And then there isn't also this thing of people going, well, if I get a job, I'll lose my benefits and I won't earn as much. I kind of need them. All
yeah.
this, you know, these things are there because of that. The you summed it up perfectly of incriminating nature of acquiring benefits. The kind of, so why do you need them? How badly do you need them? How disabled are you? How broken are you? Or whatever else.
A common theme after brain injury is just constantly justifying your disability.
Yeah.
Whether that be to the people that are handing out the benefits,
and that's
whether friends,
well,
family.
Because you want to get over it too.
Yeah,
you so to constantly have to go, oh, by the way, I'm not fixed yet.
Yeah.
By the way, I thought I would be, but I'm not. How horrific is that to have to put your hand up and say that, essentially, when that's the thing you're trying to fight against anyway? You want... Most people will want to be off of benefits. That's going to be their goal
Everyone
too.
Everyone I work with would do anything to have a job.
Yeah.
Would do anything to provide for their family. But
exactly.
Right now, that's just, it's not possible.
Yeah.
And yeah, the more and more they have to justify their disability, something that they didn't ask for,
yeah.
It was just acquired overnight, that has been this insane emotional adjustment journey. Yeah, why do I have to sit in front of you, who's never met me before, say, I'm not doing well. Like,
yeah.
I do need a bit of help.
I admit that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's quite, I don't know. But we're working on it.
And you're doing a lot of work in Parliament to try and give a voice to the voiceless here, or, yeah, those with invisible disabilities and such.
Mm.
So tell me a little bit about what's happening there and what the process is.
So, we are... So Headway UK...
Yep.
Are doing this Right First Time movement, which is great. So they sent out a survey to about 650 people, the survivors of brain injury, about how they feel the PIP process was for them. So this is kind of homing in on the personal independence payment. How did they experience? What was their experience of claiming this disability? This benefit?
Yeah.
And obviously, the majority of people came back saying it was really quite an awful, traumatic, another kind of traumatic process for us. They're going to kind of compile that in a report. So that's kind of Headway UK. That's what they're doing, which is fantastic. And then Chris Bryant, who is a local MP, I believe, of Romford, he is working with UKBIF, the United Kingdom Acquired Brain Injury Forum.
Okay, you nailed that.
So, yeah, I know. So we've set up an all-parliamentary group,
right.
And that is just to discuss and just to bring to Parliament the fact that people with acquired brain injury, the level and complexities that come and that are associated with brain injury are, I feel, as well, quite unique to brain injury.
Yeah.
You know, we sometimes find ourselves being put under the umbrella of mental health.
Yeah.
Which needs to, you know, is a very important umbrella itself.
Completely.
But we are different, I feel, you know, brain injury. So we kind of bring it to them and say, you know, the benefits, you know, the education surrounding it, the health system, all of this, it's not currently adapting to this complex nature.
Yeah.
And we need
a complex nature that's hard to articulate with tick boxes or anything like that, which again is a nightmare for any parliament or governmental system to hear, because that means it's going to be more personal one-on-one work. It can't be as simple as here's the score you have to get the benefits. It can't be as
and
simple
as that.
And it
actually is a scoring system. You know,
mad,
it is a point
it?
System.
Yeah.
And how you kind of put anyone, yeah, like you said, in those boxes. And brain injury, again, it's fluctuating. People do have good days and bad days. And why should we... Why should we incriminate somebody for having a good day? We should celebrate that and say,
"John,
fucking get on, mate." Like, I mean, keep benefits.
Yeah.
Because obviously by you having this steady income, and let's not lie, like these benefits, we're not talking a lot.
No.
You know, the standard rate of care for PIP is £57 a week. And that's supposed
that's
to,
crazy.
You know, and the whole process of applying for it is generally, if it gets to the end stage, which is a tribunal.
Yeah.
You know, going to a tribunal with a judge.
Yeah.
With somebody with a disability, it takes about 9 months. So, yeah, I mean, we're not talking...
No, and it's tiny, it's tiny enough amounts that it's... If you have a good week and don't need that money for your care or health, then you deserve to spend it on celebrating that you've had a good week.
Yeah.
It's 57.
Go outdoors, you know, go to the cinema, take your mate out.
Do something, yeah.
It
shouldn't be a case of, well, you don't need it this week or this month. It's like... Good. Enjoy it then. Because you've not been able to enjoy it for the last 3 years that you've been having it. You've been surviving off it.
Just about. Yeah. So that's kind of what we're bringing up with the UKBIF stuff. I feel really privileged to be a part of that. And then also, I went to Parliament earlier on in the year to speak to somebody from the Department of Work and Pensions.
Yeah.
And I just highlighted to them you know, I took their figures off their website and I just said, look, for me, something's missing and I don't know what that is. And I really need your help to let's identify this together. So basically what's happening is that, you know, we're going to these assessments and I'm advocating with them and supporting them. And obviously, you know, they're expressing as much as they can about how their disability affects them. So they're, and I'm, yeah, they're supporting. And what I'm listening to is like, this person is really struggling. Like everything they're doing, every single day, they're waking up exhausted. Mm. No, they can't make themselves a meal. They're living on shit. You know, they're living on microwave burgers, and even that's an effort. So, you know, nutrition, all of this, you know, and mood and engaging with other people. Their wife has left them. Their children don't recognise their dad. They're scared of their dad because their temper is a bit kind of, you know, shorter. They're impulsive. They spent all the money that they did have. They've invested it in some scam, potentially, because, again, they're vulnerable. So this is what I'm hearing. And I'm hearing, hang on, this person has... I feel this person has justified themselves enough that they can get 50-odd quid a week, all right?
Yeah.
That's it. So we leave the assessment. And then we get back the assessment paperwork of everything that happened within that assessment. And it's come back as no points. Every time. And we're talking 0 points the majority of the time. Yeah. And so this is what I was just trying to say, that there is something missing here, that, because then we go to a tribunal. So we have to do this whole process. Sorry, this is really dull. So then we do a process called a mandatory reconsideration, where we say, could you just look at this again, actually? I'm a bit concerned that you've missed something here. So they look at it again and then they say, no, we're going to stick by this. Not entitled. And then we go to this tribunal. We get to the tribunal, and some of the times we walk in and the judge may say, I'm so sorry, I don't know why you're here. You know, even by just seeing you now, I've read the paperwork, the fact you've come all this way, you're entitled, you know, it's done. And we've got 100% success rate of going to a tribunal. Like the casework team here, we've not lost one. And that's not down to us.
So again, it's probably may not be able to say, but that means 100%. Failure rate on their part from where I'm sitting is that if they've had two looks at it and said, no, you don't, and then the second it's looked at properly, they go, of course it is, then that's a huge problem. That's not anyone scamming here. That's not anything dodgy. That's a judge then looking over it properly and going, good Lord, this is ridiculous.
And sometimes they're very apologetic, and they are an independent tribunal service. They are, and this is, and I must kind of express that this is just our personal experience with the DWP. I'm sure that there are that for other people, and you know, I'd like to think that, you know, with other disabilities and things, that it does work. But I guess what this is highlighting is people are just not as knowledgeable, maybe.
Yeah.
In these situations, as they should be about brain injury,
completely.
And that makes me a bit sad because we're so passionate here, and I certainly am, and I just, and it's fascinating. It's not like a boring subject, The brain is really fascinating. So but that's not reflected. So we really
but that's it, isn't it? It's the potential lack of areas of expertise or departments there that again, it's far easier for an assessor to go, yeah, you can't walk.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
That's a really easy day's work of assessment coming. It's really simple.
That's visible. I can see that.
You've still not got an arm. Yeah. Sweet, there you go, done. Yeah. That's signed off. Whereas it's more complex here, as you've seen, that it's, again, 100% of your experience of it is, I've got it wrong.
And I think, I'm not picking myself up here. I don't think it's anything to do with what I'm doing by going with them. I just think, you know, that actually being heard from somebody who's independent.
But the difference is that the difference that you're making is that it's getting looked at again. Because potentially if you weren't there, if they've sat there and gone through that traumatic event and the person turned around and go, there's nothing wrong with you.
Yeah.
A lot of people aren't going to persist on that or aren't going to look further. Are then going to have to deal with the fact that everything they're going through is real, yet there's nothing wrong with them. They've been told there's nothing wrong with them, yet they're experiencing it. So, again, without the assistance and the care there, That's terrifying.
And I think you've just picked up on a really important point, is that literally having it in black and white, saying there's nothing wrong with you,
you're fine,
yeah, is just so contradictory for the whole journey that they've been through, from the doctors, from the nurses. You know, they may have just finally started to accept that, things aren't quite how they used to be, and I'm exploring and I'm experimenting a bit, but it's hard and it's difficult, but I'm doing it. You know, and then to just get it written down, be like, no, come on, go back to work.
Yeah.
You can do it 7 days a week, off you go.
You're fine.
Just like you used to. Yeah. It's like, ah, come on.
Again, it puts it all the more pure, it puts all of it purely inside yourself, and that is a huge weight to carry. That's someone outside saying, everything's fine out here, mate. And everything's all good out here, and you're and inside the frying pan's on fire, the alarms are going off, and the person outside the house is going, no, all is fine, all good, and you're burning. Really,
That's terrifying. A great analogy. Yeah. And I think as well, the other thing that I think that can't be measured, which, and anyone that knows me will be like, oh God, here she goes again, but is, I think what's so underestimated in all these assessments, in anything that where people are judged on how disabled they are, especially again with brain injury, is fear.
Yeah.
That people are just so scared all the time, and that's why they present in certain ways, and that's why they behave in certain ways. And, you know, there's a great guy called that I really like, called Kit Malia, who does a lot about cognitive rehab therapy, which is therapy kind of based for people with brain injuries. It's not for everyone, but I personally found him very helpful. And he kind of explains it as, you know, there is this background B, and, you know, so like my background B is like, okay, it's like, it's Friday night, I don't have to work at the pub tonight, I'm really happy about that, I might have a glass of wine. Can I afford that glass of wine? What am I going to have for dinner? That's kind of going on all the time in the back of my mind. You know, while I'm talking to you, I'm thinking, I mean, not so much, but, you know,
my background B generally is constantly, how long until I'm home again?
Yeah.
For some reason, my comfortable place is at home. I can be having the best night out, and I'll be thinking, I could probably leave in about half hour, and that'll be all right.
Yeah.
Right, which is bizarre and weird. Even if I'm having a wonderful time, I've always had that kind of...
But that's your beat.
How far am I from home?
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah. Physically, time, mentally.
Sure, and actually, I experience that a lot more now I live in London, definitely. Yeah, yeah. Like, because it is kind of the logistics. Yeah, how am I going to get home?
Yeah, I need to get back.
What time is it going to be? Yeah. Is the kebab shop still going to be open?
Yeah.
So, yeah, and they're kind of our background beat. I mean, it's nothing too stressful at all. You know, some days are probably a bit worse than others, you know, if the rent's due and whatever.
Yeah.
For somebody with a brain injury, their background B is constantly going to be, am I ever going to go back to work? Does my wife or my husband still love me? Are my children scared of me? I'm not providing for my family. You know, I can't get out of bed, but I really can't tell my wife why or my husband why. You know, I'm just, I don't really feel like I'm surviving anymore. And if that is your constant background B, and actually almost as well, kind of physically it could be. So we've got an amazing part of the brain, which is my favourite part, called the amygdala, which is our fight or flight.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, that if you see it as a light switch. So if I'm ever feeling fear, like maybe if I'm walking home down the old Cali and I'm walking home and I hear footsteps behind me, and all of a sudden my amygdala might think about being switched on, but my, you know, the logic of my brain can be like, no, come on, Nat, like, have a look behind you. You're probably fine. You probably know him. It's okay. Yeah. You're nearly home. Don't worry about it. If the footsteps start to speed up, my amygdala might just switch on and be like, actually, Nat, make a run for it.
Yeah.
Sort of go for it. And that can do that. And that's when I feel fear. But I think for somebody with a brain injury, like, sometimes that amygdala, your amygdala is just always switched on.
Yeah.
And it's just constantly just going on in the background of all those really intense, life-changing concerns for you. And, you know, not only are you processing that, you're processing, you know, being tired. You're already exhausted physically because your brain is having to work.
And that's a thing that's worth highlighting as well. As you said, with the tree in the stomach scenario, many people who have everything that we've talked about here, they've got something else they're having to deal with as well, because it's often from some kind of accident or injury. So they will either have a leg that's recovering or an arm that's healing or all these other things.
Shoulder, you know,
everything we've talked about sounds overwhelming on its own. Add to that the other results of this incident or this accident or whatever else. And
Any other physical trauma that that may have happened, or even, you know, also like the nature of how your injury happened.
Completely.
You know, while we work at the hospital, there are at times so many like police that have to be around because it was gang related.
Yeah.
They have to be there for protection. A lot of the young people and they can't go home because it happened on their doorstep.
Yeah.
You know, it's a far cry.
And again, it can be the removal of or the warping of that perceived safe place. Because again, if it happened at home, even if it's simply an accident, you're in the hospital wanting to be home.
Yeah.
But when you're home, you're reminded of how you got into the hospital. And it's this horrible loop and cycle.
And I think that's it, isn't it?
Terrifying.
I think the main thing is not only the fear that we just spoke about and how that can be... an organic physical thing that you can't really control.
Mm.
And it's just that lack of feeling safe. Wherever you go. I mean,
it really highlights just how complex and individual the situations are, because it's why it might not be an instant thought, but speeding up and making sure housing benefits are provided in a specific situation like that could be crucial, because they might not be able to start their recovery until they're in a new place or somewhere new, things like that. There's so many things like that that are so individual and unique that it needs a greater analysis and assessment than is currently going on.
And unfortunately, with the housing benefit at the moment, I mean, that's just because now Universal Credit's taking over the other benefits. So all those, those benefits are all going to be put into one. And I'm sure you've heard so. Yeah, people are having to wait like 2 to 3 months to get any of their universal credit. So the universal credit covers housing benefit, child tax credits, all of that kind of stuff. One part of ESA, like income related ESA, it all gets very complex. But people are having to wait about 3 months before they get one payment. People have become homeless because the transfer from that to that has taken an incredible amount of time, and they haven't been able to keep up with rent payment, so they're out in the streets. And
again, a lot of it will be down to, as I mentioned earlier, the situation of the relative of mine at Christmas. It will be of people who just aren't aware of the seriousness of that world, of going, we'll get it through in a couple of months, that's pretty swift. You're fine for a couple of months. Other people aren't fine for a couple of months. That's not,
I know, and I mean, I get stressed out with money, and I'm sure, everyone does. And I'd say, when it's getting, I've got two jobs, just because London is expensive.
Very expensive,
I'm so naive going from Devon. Like, Devon, £3 a pint wherever you go, pretty much. This is insane.
You see, I'm lucky because I've always lived just near enough to London, so I've always had that awareness of, I can never live there. That seems crazy. Whereas if you're that bit further away, you're like, everyone wants to go to London. Yeah. Whereas I'm like, I'm near enough.
I'm quite near enough.
Thank you very much. But I'll start to wrap things up now. But so, how can people find out more, help, engage, get help for people that may need help, get help for themselves?
So if anyone is potentially listening to this and thinking, okay, I can kind of relate to this, or I had some kind of brain trauma, Headway UK have a great website. So it's just headwayuk.org, I think. You can put it into Google, and you can find your nearest Headway. So we are kind of all over the country. So there's a really useful helpline as well. It can be like certain days there are nurses that manned it as well, so you can talk.
And is that for, can that provide assistance and guidance to her, to friends and relatives as well? Because that's something it's all these subjects. For me, the priority is the individual. That's the most important bit there. But that doesn't mean everything else should get overlooked. And they're the areas that are more likely to get overlooked completely rather than overlooked in small areas or whatever.
Definitely. There are some amazing like fact sheets, booklets about anything you could possibly think of about brain injury in relation to, so there's sorts like brain injury and friends, brain injury and sexual relationships, because that's obviously a huge thing as well that we probably don't have time to cover. But again, it's a really important element and an aspect of your life, and you should be allowed to express that and have support with that. But again, yeah, people kind of feel shy, or, you know, all professionals feel a bit kind of, oh, I don't know how to really approach that.
I feel a bit uncomfortable about sex.
Whereas, you know, and I've some of the most incredible, insightful and important chats I've had with people have come from talking or ending up talking about their sexual experiences or how they view sex now after a brain injury.
And again, for getting to feel like yourself again, or getting to feel worth or valued, that's a big part of our society, is sexuality, is all of these things. From your teens, that's kind of how a lot of things is what...
And what makes you kind of who you are.
It's a huge part. But again, it's something that will be overlooked because it's not survival, or it's not feeding yourself, or anything else. It's like,
but in a hierarchy of needs, if you look at the hierarchy of needs, it's food, food, shelter, water, and sex.
Yeah.
Like, it is part of it.
And again, that hierarchy is fucking adjustable as well. If you're on a night out and the option is a kebab or going home with someone, it's a tough choice. But it's not always going to be the kebab. It might be sometimes.
Exactly.
But it's not always going to be. So again, as much as we're making light of it, it's hugely important.
It is, and it should be.
I think you're completely right that it's something that even those that are helping you might not feel comfortable. Equally, if you're a man and the person helping you is a woman, you might not feel comfortable. If you're a woman, the person helping you is a man, you might not feel comfortable. So,
and at the moment here at Headway East London, we're really exploring kind of sex and sexuality following a brain injury. And obviously all of our members are involved in that at the moment. And just having the initial chats about how they feel about, talking about it more openly, or what can we do as Headway East London to ensure that you feel safe to talk to us about sexuality. So I'm really excited about that, and I think it should be spoken about more. So Headway UK's website, they have all that kind of stuff, general information, education about the brain as well, which is a great starting point, actually, because sometimes just knowing a bit more about the brain allows you to understand what's happening to you. You know, there's still all these theories that we only use 10% of our brain, which is bollocks, obviously, because if we did, I wouldn't be in a job, because if you damage one part, then you'd have 90% to take over, right? So education, I would always say, is really important. If you've got a bit of time, just have a look at the brain. It is fascinating. So Headway UK have all that kind of stuff on their website. But then we have a really new, exciting... We're going to plug something now.
Plug away.
It's called the Matter magazine. So it's a magazine created by Headway East London and the members. It's basically showcasing everything we do here. As we were talking, we've got all of our art. We've got the garden stuff, our supper clubs, and we just have some exceptionally interesting characters here and amazing people. And it's showcasing them. And it's been created by members. Editing was all done by members.
That's fantastic.
So it's on our website. It's called Matter. So you can get it on the website, mattermag.org. It's £5, but it's more like a book. I don't think it's a magazine. It's definitely a book. And I would, if anyone wants to just explore and learn a bit more about us, then that would be great.
That's fantastic. Is there anything else that you need to plug before we wrap things up? I want to make sure we get everything in and it's as beneficial as possible.
No, I really, just want to plug the magazine. And I hope that, people have a good look at it.
Oh, well, thank you very much for your time and for showing me around. I met two different people here who showed me some music, some art, and just the thing that I liked was that the most popular area wasn't the art room or the music room or the garden. It was just the communal area. Yeah. So that's just... I thought it would be, people are kind of losing themselves in these different areas, which I'm sure are very busy as well at different times, but the fact that the communal area was just people playing dominoes together, playing games, interacting and chatting and seeming relaxed and happy, that seemed key.
Yeah, absolutely. That's
perfect.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks.
You've been listening to Scroobius Picks Discretion Pieces.
There we go. I think you'll agree that was a hell of an episode. As said, do check out Headway and Headway East London specifically on social media, or head to headway.org.uk. They've got a phone number of 0808 800 2244 if you want to ring them to, yeah, again, it's a subject that means the fucking world to me. And yeah, I think it's important, and it's great that there's these services out there to help people with this, because it is, you know, an injury or an affliction or whatever you want to call it that can feel so isolating, because it's all going on inside your own head and it's not visible to anyone else. It's not from anyone else's perspective. No one else can see or truly understand it. No matter how much they try, no matter how empathetic they are or sympathetic they are, no one's in your own head. And going through those changes is, yeah, unimaginably tough. So, yeah, that was that. I'll be back next week. Let me have a look at who I've got next week. I've got my list here. Hang on. Give me a second. I've got a lot of good ones. I recorded one. So the plan for the next few weeks at present is next week will be Jamie Demetriou, who's got a new series called Stashlet's Flats, which is fantastic. That should be next week. There might be some juggling around. There often is. I've got Kate Nash lined up and confirmed. I've recorded one with Dan Skinner, aka Angelos Epithemiou, and I talked to both of them. I talked to Angelos and to Dan. I've got a Simon Pegg lined up to pop back on. If you didn't catch him before, go back and find that one. I think that was in the first 100. I've got Chilly Gonzalez coming on, who's one of my favourite artists of all time, so I'm crazy hyped about that. And if you have a little specials, I might be doing a little reunion one with some people have been, I think almost all of them have been on the podcast before, but yeah, I'm liking the ideas of these ones that are some gathering type ones. So whilst I don't normally go for return guests, I like the idea of having a few return guests, but having them on as kind of a drunk cast without alcohol. Or they can have alcohol if they want, I guess. But so I'm hoping, yeah, I've got a few of them potentially in mind where it will be a few guests. Because again, return guests, it's tough because, you know, we talk for 60 to 90 minutes and that's in depth. And also, most of the guests are people I know in the real world. So it's hard to remember what conversations we've had on the previous episode and what conversations we've had just casually. So I worry about going over old ground by having return guests. But yeah, as I said, I'm having a few return guests and I'm thinking of having a few kind of combination ones. I'm rambling on. Thank you for tuning in. Do you want to rate and review? I haven't asked that in about a year. I don't really care. Don't bother. Just spread the word on this one, though. That is something I am bothered about. The sad fact is the big celebrity name episodes are going to get a lot more downloads. Martin Freeman, I mean, the biggest downloads of the year so far are Martin Freeman off of everything, Elena Heady from Game of Thrones, Paloma Faith, Vicky McClure, all these amazing names, and they deserve that. But episodes like this are equally as important. You could argue more important. So, but they're not going to get the natural instant downloads of just people who are browsing and going, oh, look, it's Tim from The Office. So what really helps is if you spread the word, and whether that be on social media, which is a good way, but even, you know, old traditional way of recommending it to a friend. You don't need to be telling the world. You might just have a one person in particular that should hear this. So, yeah, please spread the word on this one. It would be really appreciated because it's an important one. Other than that, I will see you all next week. Have a good week. Ta-ta.
Hi. Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.